Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome to the show. This week's episode was recorded on location in London, England, which is where one finds Chris and Ben Blaine. As filmmakers, they go by the shared moniker The Blaine Brothers, and their first feature is the singular Nina Forever, starring Abigail Hardingham and Kean Barry as Holly and Rob, a new couple whose relationship is haunted, quite literally, by Rob's dead ex. That film is available on iTunes right now, and after you're done listening to this podcast, you should go out and watch it. Or stay in. Watch it. Just watch it. I have never seen anything like it, and it's great. Chris and Ben picked Trainspotting, Danny Boyle's spectacular 1996 adaptation of Irvin Welsh's cult novel about heroin addicts knocking around Edinburgh. Alternately exhilarating and horrifying, it opened in Cannes like an atomic bomb, paying off the promise of Shallow Grave, Boyle's previous collaboration with screenwriter John Hodge, producer Andrew McDonald, and star Ewan McGregor, and instantly putting McGregor, Johnny Lee Miller, Robert Carlyle, Kevin McKidd, Kelly McDonald, and Ewan Bremner at the top of every casting agent's must-have list. It's so energetic and ebullient that I am having a lot of trouble accepting that this year will mark the 20th anniversary of the film. But I am old, and that's happening a lot lately. Oh, and just to keep them straight in your head, Ben has the lower voice and will be the first person you hear. Chris sounds a little softer. This is someone else's movie.
So, we chose Trainspotting yesterday, actually. We were thinking of different films, yeah. But we started to realise that it was a really good one to talk about because of the way it's sort of... it's part of a British tradition of filmmaking that's definitely affected us.
Yeah,
we make stuff.
And I think also a British tradition of filmmaking that a lot of people kind of, I suppose it's easy to confuse, because there's the tradition of British filmmaking that a lot of people kind of recognise, the kind of the Ken Loach, mm-hmm. The Ken Loach mould, you know, right. But a lot of people kind of go, what is British filmmaking? It's either posh people in history,
right.
Or it's working class people now,
yeah.
And everything's grim. And it's really easy to think of Trainspotting as another film in that mould, because it's, you know, it's set up, it often feels quite a contemporary film, and it's kind of like it's people taking heroin in a housing estate. It's tough, but actually it's a fantastical film, and the kind of like the links, it links into this kind of like other type of British filmmaking, which is surreal and fantastical and creative, and kind of like it feels like it kind of inherits from
Dennis Potter.
Yeah, Dennis Potter massively, and what am I thinking, Chris?
Monty
Kubrick.
Python.
Yeah, Monty Python.
And also, Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, and Lindsay Anderson as well, actually.
Lindsay
Anderson
especially, yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And that sort of sense of, particularly with like Lindsay Anderson and Stanley Kubrick, that's the sense of this kind of like young man fighting against everything and how there's that real sort of surrealism that comes out of that frustration, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. And like Clockwork Orange, the central character, the narrator figure, is an incredibly articulate, incredibly intelligent person who is railing against, you know, not just the system that he's in and the society that he's trapped in, that incredible monologue, which apparently used to be in the middle of the film, and then they realized that they needed an opening, so they put it there. And it does, it just galvanizes you. It's an absolutely incredible monologue, but the person delivering it, like Renton, is such a fantastic figure to be young and connect to, because
yeah.
He does seem, he's very watchful, he's very observant, he's very smart, but he also seems really, really likable.
Yeah.
And that's the way you get in. The same way Alex charms you into Clockwork Orange until you realize what he does for fun.
Yeah, I mean, and you were saying this earlier when we were discussing it this morning, actually, in both cases, that's actually casting as much as
anything. Yeah, oh. Yeah, you're kind of going like, if you didn't have someone like Ewan McGregor, who actually a lot of the time in other films, you watch him and you're like, oh, he seems a bit much, you know? He seems a little bit like, oh, I'm not quite sure if I enjoy him as much. And you're kind of like, okay, why is that? And you're like, well, in Trainspotting, he's still his incredibly likable self, but his character isn't likable at all.
Yeah.
He just
yeah.
completely fucks everyone over.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing that he does that's nice for anyone. And he doesn't like anyone either. He's just a complete misanthrope. And yeah, in somebody else's, you know, face, you'd be kind of, oh, this is a really down film and, you know, I just don't like that guy. But there is just something so inherently likeable about Ewan McGregor. And it's Michael McDowell, isn't it?
Yeah, Malcolm McDowell.
And yeah, same with him. And like, because, yeah, he's if as well, isn't he?
Yeah. Mm.
So you're kind of like, you know, that.
And a lucky man as well, again.
Yeah,
again, he's another one of those actors who just has that incredible charisma that you're quite happy to watch him kicking a tram to death in the subway, and you're like, yeah, I'm probably sort of on your side, kind of. And you're like, hang on, wait a minute, no, I'm not at all. How did you do that to me?
But you sit there and you think, oh, I'm sure he has a good reason.
Yeah,
he can't be mean. I like him, but yeah. that identification with the sociopath essentially, and Renton, I think. The more time we spend with him, the variations that we see in who he is when he's high, and when he's not, and when he's finally off.
Yeah,
there is some redemption, but he's not a good person.
No.
He'll be paying for that for a long time.
Yeah, but I think also the interesting thing is, like, you get to understand, like, his mates are a pain in the ass, and it's like, it's not like you kind of go, oh, he's being mean to nice people. Mm. You go, you know, Sick Boy has no real redeeming characteristics, neither does Begbie.
Yeah.
Like, Spud's a sweetheart, you know.
And he's nice to Spud.
And he's
nice
the to, one who's protected. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and like, it definitely is a story in which you go along and you're like, yeah, I don't think you should be friends with these guys. And he does then screw them over. And you're like, yeah, you know, like, that's sort of fair enough.
Yeah.
But, like, I suppose the point, you know, so like, there's, it's not like you're still going, oh, he's being horrible to nice people. He's being horrible to horrible people.
Yeah.
But he certainly is being horrible to horrible people, and there never at any point when he's nice to anybody. You know, it's like the only thing that he does in the entire film that is actually kind of like an altruistic act is leaving that money for Spud at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think he's also... he's horrified to find out how young Diane is, so there's that too, right? There's a level.
That's true,
when we see him figure out what the line is. And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Because we have, as you say, because we have Begbie and Sick Boy, who are monsters... You can appreciate Renton. Like, that's why we root for him, because there is just a tiny bit of maybe not good, but, you know, chaotic neutral in him.
Yeah. There is always a question, isn't there, about...
Nice little role-play reference coming in there.
Yeah, like, huge nerd.
But, like, yeah, characters, how you can get away with having somebody that is actually quite a mean character, really, is, well, the people that are around them are meaner.
Yeah,
which, again, is what Clockwork Orange does massively. It's kind of like, he goes, here's a horrible person, now the state's going to be really horrible to him. You're like, oh, okay, I kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's an easy rooting choice. We're with the guy whose brain has been messed around with.
Yeah,
And sympathetic to him in the end, ultimately.
Yeah.
I've seen Clockwork Orange with an audience that didn't quite know how to play it, which was fascinating.
Yeah.
It was a 40th anniversary screening at MoMA.
Oh, wow.
In New York. The things that are funny didn't play as laughs, and the things that are horrifying didn't play as horrifying. People just sort of sat there and took it.
All right.
And tried to figure out what the reaction of everybody else in the room. Like, I could feel the room shifting. And then with Trainspotting, the first time I saw that was in Toronto in 96, I guess it would have been June when the press screen, 10 o'clock in the morning, and we just went out on a high, a total searing high. The 40 of us who were there in this big theater. And then I went back and saw it with an audience a couple of weeks later, and I had the same experience as the Clockwork Orange. They didn't quite know how to take it for the first 45 minutes or so.
Mm.
And then, I think it was after the scene of Spud in the bed, with that huge button at the end, with the flipping of the sheets.
Yeah.
Then they laughed, and it just didn't stop. Even after the baby dies, after Don dies, they were still with it. They were so completely into it. And it was really scary at the end, because people came, you know, you come out of the theater pumped and you're looking to break stuff, I think.
Yeah. Excited. Yeah, I suppose it's such a strange film in a way that it's so about friendship and being in a group of friends that, I mean, in the end, obviously, he needs to get away from them, but actually it really celebrates in the fun that you have in your friendship groups.
Mm.
And even if you're not taking heroin or having babies die on you, You know, you don't need to be at all at that extreme, or indeed having like a psychopath who, you know, is living around your house. You're like, there's been those times when you've had somebody stay around at yours and you really want them to go. You know, like, you can really empathize with every single one of those characters, even though what they're doing is usually, hopefully, more extreme than what anybody else actually has to live in the audience.
Yeah.
It's a film with a weird tension, though, between, like, all the way, in all sorts of different ways, between... It's often saying two things simultaneously, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's like that, exactly that, where you enjoy the friends and you kind of, you walk out of the film and you're like, yeah, that's a film about a really tight group of friends. But when you watch it coldly and break down what happens, it's for people who hate each other. Like, they never do anything, like, you know, like, they're always screwing each other over, and the whole message of the film is get away from these people. And the kind of the conclusion is very definitely he gets away from them, and that's a good thing, and you feel pleased that he's finally escaped from these awful people. And yet at the same time,
they're all really good fun,
and you love those people.
Yeah.
It's really, and it's I think it's fascinating that it sits, and I mean, again, there's the other thing about when he moves to London, he has that lovely bit where he says, you know, there was no society and I was really glad not to be part of it. And that's such a kind of, there's this really fascinating thing about his relationship to Thatcherism, mm-hmm. which, you know, because obviously it's set, actually set in the 80s, it's sort of the height of kind of all of that. And where it sits politically is really complex, because again, he is actually almost a kind of like a really kind of like pro-Thatcherite figure in terms of how he behaves. And yet at the same time, he's sort of there to exemplify, in some ways he also exemplifies everything that's wrong with that ideology. And yeah, it's that fascinating thing of the film never quite says one thing or the other, and just sits there giving you everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, it makes you work quite hard as an audience.
It's interesting in terms of whether the reaction to, like, Clockwork Orange, where you're going 40 years on, and obviously it's a film that's had a lot of opprobrium about it for many years, and to the point where, you know, people are you've definitely got the sense of, no, you're not allowed to laugh at that, that's not allowed.
Yeah.
So I can see how you can be sitting in an audience being like, oh, I'm not sure if I should be saying anything. And Trainspotting, I suppose it did have a whole load of opprobrium about it when it came out.
Yeah, it really did. Yeah.
Which was all, you know, well, it's glamorising drug use.
Yeah.
Which you can only say if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's kind of incredible that every politician then subsequently had to say, well, I haven't seen it, but I've seen the trailer and it looks like everyone's having fun. Yeah, guy's arm falls off. Remember that? No, you didn't see that part.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of horrific stuff that happens in it, but I suppose it's kind of, it's interesting how much the whole film has a musical soundtrack to it, where like literally a song will finish and then the next one will start, you know, like there's maybe half a second before the next track jumps in, and so all the way you've got this thing that drives you along and makes it feel that much more enjoyable than if you were play, you know, if you did play that without, I mean, like, I'm trying to think actually, so what does play underneath the so when the babies died,
it's that trip hop mix, right?
Or is that Blur going on there?
Is that that's what when he discovers that the baby's died.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. The music is earlier in the hallucination.
A point at which you don't have music?
I think that might be one of the few points where you don't have music. Yeah. There's definitely a trip hop stuff when he's coming clean and you've got the baby on the ceiling.
In other people's hands, you'd be like, I mean, that is quite a testing sequence.
But I can't remember which track it is, but it's when he goes, so you've got it was like a full-time job, and you've got this is the guide to how you live on heroin.
Yeah.
And then that ends and it's like, but it wasn't always fun, and then she starts screaming,
right?
And that there is, yeah, you're right, there's no music under that.
And so you think in terms of the film, if it didn't have wall to wall music, would you actually enjoy it quite as much?
Yeah.
Would you have that same propulsion to it, where again, they're using not having music for a very specific reason?
And it very much is that thing of like, you could play so much of it for horror and for appallingness. And actually, it plays a lot of the things that... It doesn't hide from how horrible they are, but, you know, it's bright colours, it's music, it's, you know, a really nice edit, and you're like, this is... I mean, like the worst toilet in Scotland, which is, I mean, again, a fascinating sequence where you go... you come in there and that's absolutely horrific and it's absolutely disgusting. And then you have...
Becomes the most beautiful sequence in the film.
Exactly, yeah. And also, there's that. I mean, that's the first time that it's totally surreal.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's one of... And again, it's what's so nice about it is that no one particularly talks about it as a piece of surrealism. And people often kind of, you know, like the, you know, the sort of the fantastical things, people always like relate back to them taking drugs. But at that point, he's not actually high. I mean, the whole point is... I'm no longer high, I definitely have to shit. That's because I'm not high. And yet, that suddenly, out of nowhere, he does this impossible thing and does this impossible, beautiful sequence. And I think that's really... I think it's just really exciting to see a film that, where it can be surreal and it's not kind of like... It doesn't have to... You don't have to put the brakes on, you don't have to apologise for it, you don't have to explain it. It just does this beautiful thing that's emotionally true.
Yeah, and you're going, so there's like this huge visual metaphor of your, you know, emotion, the joy that you are getting for actually, you know what, I have managed to get those things, those bloody things back.
Yeah.
From this awful situation, that actually, the buzz on that must be pretty high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the thing that Boyle and Hodge did together, which they haven't worked together in a while, but the thing that John Hodge and Danny Boyle did do was play amorality for joy, like just...
Yes,
Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, maybe not so much A Life Less Ordinary, but definitely the beach as well has that Game Boy sequence where something, he's not exactly doing something terrible, but he's fleeing all responsibility and abandoning everything in his life, and it's still fun because he's having fun. And when he comes down, that's when the film goes dark and everything goes terrible, and I just suddenly realized how hard it is to find a copy of The Beach, and I really want to watch it again. I still think there's some good stuff in it. I'm really fascinated by all of Boyle's output, but the films he made with Hodge are sort of seething in a different way with stuff. I've interviewed Boyle a number of times over the years, and he said that, you know, his running gag when he refers to his own work is that he likes to create specimens rather than characters. He'll just watch people suffer and figure out what they're going to do next, which is sort of summed up perfectly in 127 hours.
Yeah.
But it's in, you know, it happens in Sunshine. It certainly happens in his earlier films where it's just a question of which move will be made first. And Trainspotting, although it doesn't present itself as a puzzle piece, it really is moving into that direction where, you know, you put Renton under the microscope and what is he going to do?
Yeah.
And how did he get to these points and now what? But the film is, I mean, as you say, the score is so much part of it. It is done with so much joy and so much, your pulse doesn't slow down and you're not allowed to stop having fun right up until he wants you to be confronted he wants to confront us with this horrible reality.
Yeah. I mean, again, a really good example of that is actually Begbie, where you go at the start, Begbie's violence is enjoyable.
Oh, yeah.
It's really good fun to watch. And
it's introduced with him casually throwing the glass over
and the freeze frame. Yeah. And it's like, hey, you know, it's
all we've all done this.
Yeah. Happy days.
And then also when you get to the bit where, you know, okay, so there's like a brief moment with, okay, this is the woman who's actually had the glass smash over her head. She's full of, you know, covered in blood.
Yeah.
But then it just goes straight away into, I'm going to have this fight with these two big guys, and that's going to be fun. And then you don't even watch it. You just you watch the friends, and you've got a real, like, to be honest, the only time I've seen a chair fly like that is in Asterix cartoon. and all the friends are kind of like, oh, here we are again. And you don't pay any attention to the violence.
Yeah,
and then you get to the end and the fight in the pub in London, and when he glasses the guy... It's really disgusting. Like, it's kind of like, horrible. It's a short moment, but like, it really feels like you see the guy's like chin or throat being cut open, and it's really.
Yeah, it cuts, so you get the glass into the face, but then it come. You know, they do cut back to him on the floor, covered in blood. That they, you know, it's not just once. Oh, okay, we're not going to see that again. It's no. Here you go. Here's a close up of him.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you see Spud with his cut hand, like quite. You keep coming back to that as well. You know, and it's like that moment is suddenly really unpleasant, and that's, I mean, totally in the directorial choices. And again, that's where you get the fantastic when Begbie makes him light the cigarette for him, and it's the first time when suddenly like they're both in total silhouette and completely oppositionally shot, and you kind of like, it's no, there's nothing else like that in the whole film, and suddenly it's just going. It's that really interesting way how as a director you can take a thing and go, this now needs to be tense. This now needs to be, he's actually the baddie. It's like, until now he can be comedy, he can be fun and an annoyance, but now he's evil.
Yeah.
And it's just like showing that through the shots and through the edit, rather than that needing to be a piece of kind of like cleverly worked plot mechanic of kind of like, oh, you've led us to this revelation. It's like, no, we've all sort of known that.
Yeah.
But it's just you're framing it in a different way now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It isn't until that moment, I think, that Renton realizes that that Begbie is a danger to Renton, to him.
Yeah.
And so we finally get to see it too. Because, in the beginning, the first bar fight is fun. It's something they'll remember later and laugh about when they're, you know, sufficiently recovered. Yeah. But now it's scary. Now it's bad.
Yeah.
So I guess the other question I wanted to ask is, you know, what was your first experience of it? When did you guys see it and how old were you?
So I'm trying to think. I'm not sure I saw it in the cinema.
I know I didn't. I think I didn't actually, because I'm a stubborn bastard, so I think it came out and everyone went crazy for it.
I think I read the book first.
Yeah, you read...
I used to, especially whenever films were coming out and they were based on a book, I would read the book.
Okay.
I'm pretty certain I read the book first. And the book's amazing. And what's so great about it is it's not just told from Renton's point of view. It's not just, in his voice. It's in every single characters, and they all get their own chapters, and there's a whole load more characters. There's so many different characters who are talking to you directly, and he never starts a chapter by saying, "This is Renton, by the way."
Yeah.
You just know exactly just by the way that they're written, which is like pretty astounding when you've got so many different characters and each and every single one of them is really distinct, and just from the way that it's been written.
Well, yeah, I mean, even to the point of dialect, people have thicker dialects in text. Yeah. It's kind of incredible in plain text to see that. I read the book afterwards. I came to it later. But, I was 28 maybe? 27, 28 when it came out in Canada. And it was just, you know, I'm 10 years older than the target audience, I suspect, but it's still just the cinema of it just got me. I loved it so much. And I'd already seen Shallow Grave and was waiting for it. And so it played Cannes, and there was all this fuffer about what was happening, and then the studios got right behind it. I think I'm remembering this correctly. Miramax bought it, and naturally, because they're Miramax in the 90s, they botched the release in North America. They botched the American release. Trainspotting made, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but I'm pretty sure it made either 15 or 16 million, and most of that was made in Canada.
Right.
Because we Canadians are willing to see a quote-unquote foreign movie. You can't do air quotes on a podcast. But we were willing to, and you know, Shallow Grave had done fairly well in Canada. I think it was a small distributor, but it played forever.
Yeah.
And they marketed it properly, and they screened it early, and they got word of mouth going, and people went to see it. Whereas in America, partially because Miramax, the Weinstein brothers, did what they always do, which is underestimate the viewing public and try to fix this movie that they bought, you know, a completed movie that they acquired. They redubbed the first 20 minutes with softer versions of the accents, which is unnecessary, but really stood out.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough that the first time I saw it, we saw a can print. So it has subtitles in the bar sequence, the one scene, you know, what are you talking about? Football?
Yeah.
Which it always had,
because
it's so loud.
Yeah,
the rest of the film, apparently, there's a subtitled version that was released.
I've heard that,
I've heard that.
I don't know how true that, if that's just a delightful apocryphal.
Yeah.
But, I mean, because that's...
I love the way that they've done that scene, because so often you're kind of like, okay, here's a scene, it's in a bar, and everybody's talking like we are now, and you're like, you can't hear each other.
Yeah.
You can't hear each other, and there you're like, yeah, you can't hear each other, we've put subtitles on as well, because... Probably you won't have actually, you know, they might not have actually got as much out of the conversation as you are.
Yeah.
But it was jarring the second time to listen to, I mean, I hope you guys have never, I know it's never been released in
this side of the Atlantic. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's still out there, and it's just evil. It's the first 20 minutes are cleaner in the audio because they've just redubbed all the dialogue. The sound, the bass sounds is still the same.
Yeah.
But there's this weird sort of softened Scottish accent thing going on where all the actors are delivering a slightly lighter version of their read.
Wow.
But you can see, like in Carlyle's mouth, the sound doesn't fit because you can see the burr in his lips. He's sort of pushing it out.
Yeah.
And then he's speaking more cleanly on the audio. And it's just, it's terrible. And so I think people go see that and they are immediately put off because you don't know why, but you're not fully connecting to it. It's like bad dubbing. It just doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell, that's when people shut off and didn't go back to it. And the idea was that they would adjust in the first 20 minutes and then it would sound normal when right. when the regular soundtrack returned. But by that point, nobody was paying attention. They'd already sort of tuned that out. And they cut one of the bounces, or at least one of the bounces of Diane on Renton, because they wanted to avoid the NC-17. As always, that was the thing that was the problem. It wasn't dead baby
or always.
People with you know severed jugular veins.
Yeah.
It was the sex.
Or the close-up of needles going in.
No, they were fine with that. Because, you know, cautionary
the exact way of how you can cook up.
Yeah.
You know.
Which, again,
yeah, no, that's all fine.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Because that, you know, for criminal intent, you'd have to actually go out and find the heroin first. So it's the movie's not fully responsible, but the sex, oh, you can't show people how to do that. That's not right.
Yeah, no, I could well imagine that it would go down really well in Canada.
We're just used to. I mean, we had just had Reading Stones released there with subtitles 3 or 4 years earlier.
Yeah. There's something about Blackley comic work. So, like, you know, we've just been touring around with Nina Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Which has underlying black comedy to it, and
a bit.
But it depends where you go.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
and the really interesting bit. We always really like to be in the cinema when we're there, and we watch the film with the audience, just to gauge the reaction to see how it actually goes down. And the further north you go, the funnier it gets. Okay. So in Scotland, hilarious. Everyone laughing their asses off all the way through, and the same in Canada.
Yeah.
But the further south you go, the more serious it gets.
Yeah.
Really? The more that people, you know, are, you know, jiving on the themes of grief it's like the metaphysical side of stuff as well, isn't it? You know, like but definitely the comedy really changes. Like the colder you get, then the funnier it gets.
Yeah.
Well, that does explain Canada liking it.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I had no... I mean, definitely there is a sadness to it that I got, but... Oh, wow. No, I would not have thought people wouldn't laugh or just laugh less.
Yeah, no. We've definitely had some screenings where there's been no laughter.
And,
you know,
and you're terrified. And you think kind of like, oh, God, this is going to be... We've got to do a Q&A now. It's going to be awful. And then, thankfully, you just get... Like, people just realize, oh, right, yeah, no, that question means... You're really engaged. You're quite upset. Oh, okay, fine. That's how you read it. Fine. That's great. You know, I'll take that. Any response is always beautiful. But yeah.
And we have one screening which was for students actually at a university where you could really feel the awkwardness in the air. And I was wondering actually, like in terms of the screenings of Clockwork Orange and Trainspotting, where you're going, you've got an audience of people who kind of feel like they're not allowed to show their reactions.
Yeah, because that was the thing that we didn't quite... Because in our heads, Nina's always been a film where you kind of go, like, surely all sorts of people like it and get something from it. But we're always kind of confident that, like, our key audience would be 20-somethings, particularly like early 20-somethings. You'd be kind of like, yeah, this is... you know, your territory, it's sort of rich for you. And so we kind of went into this screening with students feeling like, oh, are they going to love this? And then you sort of get kind of like, you know, halfway through and you're like, wow, what is this feeling? You suddenly realise they all know each other because it's the same university class and like they've known each other for a couple of years and like, you know, half of them have probably slept with the other half of them or want to sleep with the other half of them. And so you don't have this reaction of kind of like, this is my response to the film. You have... what's everyone in this room thinking about? And like exactly that. Yeah, I wonder if like, you know, the Coen brothers were sat there being like, well, I know that we're sat next to so-and-so from this place and so, and like, if we start giggling, what are they going to think of us? It's like,
yeah, that's true. It'll end up on BuzzFeed. That's amazing. Yeah, I suppose self-consciousness it wouldn't have occurred to me. But yeah, of course, if everybody knows everybody's... Plus, there's nudity, which always makes people, you know, careful or uncomfortable. And
careful. Or there was one screening in Sitges in Spain where at that festival, the audience are very kind of vocal all the way through. And they, like, clap and cheer at all sorts of different points. The first time that you saw Abigail's breasts, there was one guy who went... And it's just like, I think he expected like half the room to go up with him because it's, you know, but yeah, it was just him. And it's just like, but I love that he kept it going. He didn't, there was no shame. It was like, no, I'm committing to this.
Yeah.
No, I'm here. I'm happy.
This is why I paid my dollar. Midnight Madness in Toronto does that too. I'm sure you'll experience it at some point. The incredibly enthusiastic for anything audience, which is great, but it also gives you this kind of false positive reading because they're so stoked from the beginning.
Yeah.
But yes, it's, I can see the filmmaking people, not uncomfortable exactly, but awkward and self-conscious and just really weird. I saw it. I saw it on a link, so I saw it by myself. But projected, but it was still. It's just like that's funny and sad at the same time, and there's so much going on that I just sunk right into it. I thought it was one of those experiences where you're just like, I would love to see this with a crowd, to see what an audience, how an audience processes this.
Yeah, I think for the exact audience response that we were kind of hoping for, if you've got a full room of 150 people, then perfect. Yeah. And it feels a little bit like there's a certain size of when it gets slightly too small that you do get that awkwardness and that slight uncomfortableness of, oh, am I actually allowed to laugh here? And then when you get even bigger, it becomes much more funny.
Yeah,
because you know there's enough people that are going to laugh that you're going to just encourage everyone else to. I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's 150 seat cinema. Won that.
That's the peachiest one.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, and this brings us back to Boyle, which is you know, the idea of cinematic control, where you've created an experience for people and you are working the levers. Like you get to be in control of how people respond, whether they go, you know, happy or sad. You can sort of gauge the room, but the film is steering. Like the film is actively steering, and so is Trainspotting in a way.
Oh, Trainspotting very really is. Yeah. I mean, it's such a masterful thing that they managed to do with the film, where you're kind of going. So you're coming from a film that from a book where it goes forwards and backwards in time, and it's not doing the usual character arc thing of a film. Yeah. And in the film itself, you're going, so two people kind of have character arcs. But there's such a very definite structure to it where so many of the stories that happen are all quite random, but they seem to be following a theme. There's like five quite distinct sections, and there's a definite midpoint where things change from being, okay, this is fun, to being, okay, no, things are just going to go wrong now. And just that really simple sort of little pyramid of a structure really, really works, and really holds it together, and really makes you feel like, okay, you totally know where this story's going all the way through. It's such a, you know, such a really interesting thing to see, where you're kind of, you know, you will get drummed into you about everything needs to be because, and you can't just have an and then. And with this film, pretty much all of it is and then.
Yeah, almost the entire story is a series of and thens. But it nevertheless, because of that simple, really simple hinge in the middle of kind of like, you know, he starts out here, he gets to there, and then, okay, from now on, I'm just trying to get away from these people and they're going to come after me, but, you know, and not in a kind of like, you know, they're hunting me, but just because they're my mates and I can't tell them to leave.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a kind of nice downbeat way of that, of making that work. But yeah, it's so such a simple way of giving the audience a journey, which then enables them to have all of these kind of, just this kind of like real kaleidoscope of everything happening around it, which, it's brilliant. It's a masterful piece of screenwriting.
Yeah. I described it to somebody once years and years ago as it's like the synthesis of the two great narrative arcs of cinema. One is that it's a coming of age story where you learn to be yourself. And the other one is the noir premise of not being able to escape your past. And it's both of them. It actually does both at once, which is just so fascinating to watch, you know, like to go back and study and analyze after the fact, because it suckers you in. You don't really get either of those things hammered home, but then there's that moment where Renton's sort of set up in his new life and everything's going well, and he gets that letter and it's just like, oh, that's what this movie's about.
Yeah.
And now we have to endure that. And once again, like it's so important that the character is smart and self-aware to that extent, because that's where it becomes a heist movie, where it becomes a plan and where it gets out. And subliminally also, we have McGregor from Shallow Grave just sort of ringing that bell in the back of your mind going, you know, he's done this before, he'll be okay. He's going to get hurt, but it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And it's just really a tribute to Boyle and Hodge and McGregor that you don't feel it. It doesn't feel like a retread at any point. It's just the band getting back together and doing the difficult second album and actually making it better.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, much better, yeah.
So had you seen Shallow Grave beforehand? I mean, I'm assuming it was floating around on DVD by then.
Yeah, I'd seen Shallow Grave. And I almost actually was picking up on Ewan McGregor more from Lipstick on Your Collar.
Yeah.
Oh, the Potter.
Dennis Potter TV series, where he was really great in that.
Yeah, I think that was And again, in terms of how Potter used him, it's actually much more like how he's in Trainspotting, I think, of taking an actually not very attractive character and making you care and follow his journey, and you don't mind that he's often not behaving that well,
right,
because he just has this charm and this charisma, and you totally sort of, and you know, all of that sort of surrealness sort of exploding around him. And he's, again, in a way, you know, he's great in surreal things, because he has that sort of, he does have that weird sort of musical thing about, you know, like you could, like, he's not really, he's not
ever, he has done a musical, yeah, yeah, with
Down With Love, the Renee Zellweger film,
yeah,
from the director of Ant-Man, which I've never understood.
But yeah, it's weird he doesn't do more like that, because he has, like, he's great in that, in those.
Oh, well, and Moulin Rouge.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah, of course, yeah, yeah.
Which he disappeared into, apparently, because I didn't remember that either.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He's so, yeah. And he's really good in that, too.
Yeah, yeah, he is.
And
he
I...
He has a bit more, I, you know, it feels like with him, you want to give him some grit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You really want to give him some grit, so that, you know, you're kind of, yeah, you're anchoring. The things that you really enjoy about him, and you don't just go, hey, the things that you enjoy about him, here, you know, it's like having too much ice cream with Ewan McGregor.
But I mean, it's the same with almost everything, isn't it? It's like, it's, you know, again, it's that thing of what's so smart about Trainspotting all the way through is that you always have that tension between this is fun, this is awful, and it's like that's there in almost every aspect of the film. There's, you know, it's pulling you both ways at once.
Yeah.
And their entire lives are excess.
Yeah.
So you actually are having the ice cream effect. You're getting to, they're, you know, they're going to crash. They just don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. And it's so fast paced as well. I mean, when you look at, So, when you're editing a film and you're trying to work out the runtime, and obviously everybody wants to know the runtime, and it's really important what the runtime is.
Yes.
And
as a critic, I guarantee you that is the most important thing. Yes. Show me 96 and I'm happy.
Absolutely.
152.
Yeah. Really? Must we?
But then you're sitting there, like, when you're editing it, you don't put on any of the stuff at the start.
Mm.
You don't have any of the, you know, like,
yeah,
the, like, you know, if you just want seeing a little bit of filth.
Yeah.
And there's about 6 or 7 different companies with their logos coming up before anything happens. You know, it's like true Family Guy.
Yeah, logo. we were just asking ourselves, like, what is the start of filth? Like, how does that actually begin? And we just, like, sort of found it online, you know, online on Netflix.
Yeah,
and
we're seems
just,
like a lot of Irvin Welsh. The way that his stuff works is that, yeah, he jumps forwards first, and then, okay, now we're going to actually go back in time. So you do that in Trainspotting, that, you know, the bit that's meant to be in the middle, that he's now moved to the front, you know, then running away, and that does happen in the middle of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Filth, he's got this weird sort of dream sequence that will only make sense much later on.
Yeah.
Wedding Bells, which is a Channel 4 TV thing, which starts quite nicely with this thing with 4 women all dressed in wedding dresses killing their respective you know, husbands to be.
Okay.
Kicking them in the docks.
Yeah.
And that plays out in a really nice way, and it's a really nice way of setting up this stuff will come.
Yeah.
And so Filth, I don't remember how many, but I remember a lot. A lot of logos
at the front.
Yeah.
There's one that's worse, and it played at the film festival at TIFF last year, because I saw it with an audience, and it just kept going. And after a while, the audience started to laugh too. They would just, they would see.
Turbo Kid has
a few.
Turbo Kid's got loads.
No, that played after dark, I think. No, the
what you were just saying, like, as a critic, kind of like 96 minutes, I'm happy. It's like, with the opening card logos, that effect is like magnified. So it's like when they're like a 10 second thing, you're like, okay, that was fine. But then you get the one where it's like, da-da,
yes. Da-da.
Come on, I've got it. You put your money in, move on.
Yeah. And you don't have the credits either at the end of the film.
Sure.
And so when you're editing it, you're kind of like, well, this is perfectly fine. It's like 92 minutes. And then you're like, put the things on the front and the back, and you're like, oh, it's 98. How did that happen? You know? Like, we've stressed so much over seconds, over trying to get this thing like as tight as possible. And now we've just added a lot that wasn't there.
Yeah,
it's such a and then you're watching Trainspotting, and you realise that if you forget about the credits, it's 86 minutes.
Yeah,
To the end, 86 and a half.
Yeah, it's never... free train. That's just doesn't stop moving.
And you never think of it. Like, in my head, Trainspotting is a long film.
Yeah, I'm always surprised when I put it in or when I hold up the disc and realize, how like, 96, I think, Olive? That's nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's this, because they're so...
I think it's exactly 90 all in.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's so much that happens.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose that's, you know, because it does keep bouncing from, you know, another thing to another thing. And really builds up in a kind of, like the whole bit when, so he's come off drugs for the first time and they're all trying to be normal human beings and have like a relationship with the opposite sex, and they all fuck up in their own different ways in doing that. And it bounces from one to the other in kind of like, you know, in a different hands, you'd be like, well, that's Paul Thomas Anderson doing Magnolia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But obviously every single one of them is line, you know, teeing up a punchline.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, and they're all perfectly executed. They're all really funny.
Yeah. And again, I mean, that's the other, in terms of telling a story in that space and in that kind of, with that kind of velocity, what's interesting is that because it isn't built on a series of because,
right,
and therefore, you know, like, because it doesn't actually have this kind of like massive kind of plot structure to it, it has loads of time to hang around introducing characters.
Yeah.
So even though it is a breakneck thing that takes you know 86 minutes, you really care because you've really been introduced. You know, like, even though it's like, you know, like they pop up and it's almost like a series of jokes with each of them. I put perhaps in a way because of that, because each one of those kind of friends is, you have the moment where it's like, I now get to laugh at you. I then care about you because that's how a joke works. And then it's kind of like, it feels really deep because I feel like I know who these people are, and then I could, like, my imagination can fill in the blanks around it.
Yeah, they're all really real people as well, aren't they? You know, it's kind of none of the. I suppose actually, because you're kind of going, because they're just there because they are who they are.
Yeah,
they're not there because they're ciphers to get you from the, you know, whatever.
Yeah, there's
stage
no,
to the next stage. There's no threshold guardians
exactly,
like, you
know,
opening doors for you to the whatevers.
Yeah, there's no one there to help the hero on his journey. There's no
there's no journey. There's escape. It's a flight. It's the opposite of a triumphant story, except that it is triumphant in the end.
yeah. They do really well on that. You know, it's not that you're going, oh, phew, how did you get out of that? You're going, yeah, you did it.
Yeah,
you did what? You screwed over all of your mates and ran away with some money.
Which, again, is the queasy thing about, you know, it's that really interesting... I mean, it, like, the way the ending is played, but actually the way, like, the, you know, the one thing that almost everyone knows about it is Choose Life.
Mm-hmm.
But that in itself is, again, there's this sort of inherent tension to it, because it's... There's nothing positive in that speech.
Yeah.
It's never... there either at the start or in the middle or at the end, which is, like, it occurs three times throughout that script. And in none of them does he talk positively about any of the things in which he says he's choosing.
Yeah, it's never a triumph.
No, it's never. And at the end, he's going, you know, I feel pretty bad about this, but I think we can all agree I sort of had to do it. And now I've got the money, I'm going to be like you. I'm going to have my TV. I'm going to be good at golf. I'm going to be... And it's a threat.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's... And it's also, it's, you know, it is that sort of... I mean, is he staring at the camera? He's not quite staring at the camera.
Yeah, he's walking right towards
the camera. Yeah. But it's that thing of, like, it's one of those few...
It's almost like he turns into a happy face, you know, like
I remember
the Acid House happy face.
Yeah, I think that was actually... I remember sort of quite a kind of... I think it was almost like a deliberate thing of turning him into an Acid House face at the end. But yeah, but it's one of the few things in... it's one of the few films I can think of where it ends with a character looking straight to camera and it works, because I feel like, yeah, you are... That you are making a statement that is involving me,
yeah,
and it is a threat to me, and it is implicit of me, and it is questioning the way in which I've lived my life, and that, like, there is that thing of, like, well, I'm coming, you know, I'm coming for the comfort that you live in, and there's that sort of thing of being like, yeah, and the comfort that we live in is based upon the, you know, we're all part of this society, you know, it's like there is that kind of, it's a complicated thing that happens at the end in a really happy bounce, and it's like, yay, oh yeah, oh I see it
he's gonna be your estate agent.
Yeah, so he's gonna be your estate agent.
Something utterly conventional and utterly terrifying.
Yeah,
it's not metastasis, it's the other thing, it's the thing where the cell enters the system, where there's like where the pollution comes in, where the lead creeps into the water pipe or something. I was really surprised. I was kind of making little notes thing, and I made a connection that I'd never made before, but this is basically the movie that makes American Psycho possible.
Yeah,
like what Mary Harron did with that book is to be sort of Kubrickian and over the top in a way that I think Boyle sort of paved the way for unconsciously by invoking all the Clockwork Orange comparisons, because they're really, they're not similar films in any visual or stylistic way, except that they are. Clockwork and Trainspotting, which is sort of leapfrogging, and then out of that
I suppose Trainspotting, you're going, so if you're thinking of it as it's a character who is disobeying the normal laws of society, and so society wants him to become part of society, and he has to give up the thing that whatever it was that was driving him, and so you've kind of got that similar idea between the two.
But in Clockwork, it's forced, it's taken away, it's forcibly taken away from him against his will, and including Beethoven, which is why it's tragic. And in Trainspotting, it's cowardice, like he flees and goes straight is drawn back in. That's what I mean, like you can remember an image from Trainspotting and overlay the Droog costumes and it works perfectly, but there's nothing in the films themselves that connects it. It's just fascinating, they are the same story except that they're not.
It is a weird mirror image. There is, I mean,
Boyle said he was thinking about it. It was part of it, but it's just this really bizarre thing where you can look at it and it kind of isn't, and it kind of is. It fights the comparison by being so specific to itself.
The language is also, slightly more so in the book, where the language is even more, in both cases, like the language.
Jargonized, yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, it's interesting that in both cases, it's actually the initial spark, quite like for both, is verbal, and you go, you know, like the draw in writing Clockwork Orange was very much first and foremost was inventing this language, and what that then did to the way you think as a reader as you read it, and you're kind of like you're pulling yourself through this entirely alien text.
And it infects you as you read it, which is what's so fascinating about both books too.
Yeah, and you know, and I suppose the kind of the interesting, so like there's the similarity because for a lot of readers reading Trainspotting, it's a similar effect, and you're kind of like, okay, I'm having to piece this together and put, okay, now I'm able to read this properly. But of course, the mirror image thing comes in is, of course, in Clockwork Orange, Burgess has invented this language, and in Trainspotting, that's Irving going, this is how me and my mates speak, and I want to reflect my reality. And it's kind of, you know, and that's that thing. I mean, it is, you know, it's, you know, going right back to Rappy Burns, frankly, kind of like being, no, this is how we speak. This is, we're proud of, you know, this is how we're going to communicate, and you guys have to fucking get with the system and, you know, appreciate that. Which is why it is so awful that you then do a version of it with softer accents, because it's like, that's going against everything that, you know, it sort of is about. But so in a way, that mirror image is like, it's there between the two, like it is a mirror, because you're going, in both cases there's this very kind of verbal, this very thing about language and the way that, you know, intrinsically affects the way you think. But in one case it's a massive kind of like intellectual exercise, and in the other it's a really kind of passionate political exercise, frankly.
Yeah, and then you move to American Psycho, and it's really interesting to see that, because there are so many things that are similar.
It's ritualized in the same way.
Yeah, and that fantastical thing as well. You know, that's what something I always really loved about American Psycho, the film, is that you're kind of going, it's a self-aware movie, and it's willing to do ridiculous shit. Really go out there, and it's kind of like, yeah, fine, that stuff can happen. And you're never quite saying, well, it's because X, Y, or Z. There's something really nice about that, and it's more about a feeling and emotion. Again, like, you know, it's like not quite going like it's a drastically different visual metaphor, because you're going, well, you know, no, it's just a car that's exploded. It's what always happens in movies, but it kind of doesn't make any sense to have happened in this movie.
Right.
Why has that happened? And you're like, well, because emotionally, that's exactly where he's at. It's really nicely done. I think she's a lot more judgmental of Patrick Bateman.
I think she wants us to be, certainly. Yeah,
absolutely. She's like, out of the three of them, you're kind of going, she's the one who's got the firmest moral hold.
And once again, people didn't get it. They just missed it completely because of what they see rather than what they feel. And Trainspotting is so much about the feeling of what's happening and the experience of enjoying this awfulness with people, with like being, it played like a concert press screening where there were only 40 of us, but it was like watching the Velvet Underground or the Sex Pistols. It's like, I'm watching the world change right in front of me. This is never going to happen again.
Yeah.
And then that gives us, you know, Lock, Stock and all the other films that tried so hard to be that sort of lad movie. I think that's what they called them, right? But that's not what this is. Trainspotting is not about endorsing the culture or celebrating it or turning it into a Gap commercial. It's about people who learn to stop celebrating it, or at least one person.
Yeah.
And everybody forgets, like the third act, it just drops away. The reason people like this is because of what I wonder, the people who commissioned the next ones, the knockoffs, did they just watch the trailer and not the film? And just like, that's what we want. And that's why all these subsequent films don't have the moral center that's so desperately needed.
I suppose a lot of the time you're going, it's just because you're enjoying a filmic trick and you're just going, okay, cool, how did you do that? Well, I'll do something similar to that. And you know, like, so the freeze frames are coming from Scorsese, isn't it? With Goodfellas, and that continues on into Lock, Stock and God knows what else afterwards.
You get those weird camera tricks with the Gap commercial effect of, you know, turning and revolving the the axis, and I saw that and thought, why? I mean, I don't like Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. I was one of the few people who just didn't go for it at all. Within 5 minutes, just like, oh, you saw Trainspotting, I know what this is, and just turned off to it. And Snatch is a little better because it's less stylistic and more involved, and it's kind of more dialogue heavy. But
that's
but
interesting. We're kind of the opposite way around. But I think some of that again depends upon the way that you come to it. So the thing we knew about Lock, Stock beforehand was that
Vinnie Jones was in it.
Is in it, and so Sting. And you're like, and Trudy Styler, who's Sting's wife, has funded it.
Yeah,
and you're like, well, this is going to be,
like, you know, probably more so now, and particularly before you see Lock, Stock. But kind of, you go at that point, you go into a film, you go, yeah, it's Trudy Styler, it's Sting, it's Vinnie Jones. It's like, this is going to be the worst thing in the world ever.
How can something accommodate all of these things?
Yeah.
Well, it's just, you're thinking it's going to be a horrible vanity vehicle where they've cast they're going, oh, we need to get somebody who's got like a name to him.
Vinnie Jones? Sting?
He must be good at acting. Why? Because he grabbed Gazza by the balls. I mean, like, it's a really bizarre choice. And I mean, you know,
in that instance,
it's we'll give it to them, that works.
He's great. I mean, you know, he isn't great in anything else, but he's great in that film. Absolutely great in that film.
So I think we had a bit of a whale of a time. I don't think I've actually seen it since.
And it was like an Edinburgh
Film Festival.
We saw it at Edinburgh and like left that, like went in just like, oh, well, you know, what else are we going to do? And left on a high.
Okay.
And I think kind of on the back of that, just through like going back and telling people you've got to watch this, I think I saw it 3 or 4 times back then. Right. But I haven't watched it for a very long time.
Be interesting to see if it holds up or if you're kind of like, oh, actually.
I mean, I think the...
kind of want to see it again now too, just to feel fun. Maybe I got it wrong.
I don't know.
I think it's
certainly possible.
I think the interesting thing about it is that my memory of it is that what it does do is the friends and the gang, and like you really like those characters, and you kind of, it's, I remember a lot of fun. And the other thing that sticks out to me, interestingly, is the little speech that, who is it? I think it's,
Fleming?
Yeah, no.
Fletcher?
No, who is it? I can't remember the speech about tea. The speech about how it's drinking tea that made Britain great, and it's like they're all about to get ready to do the job, and one of them's like, I think it is Dexter Fletcher, is like, no, we've got to stop and have a cup of tea because that's what my, and it's like, it's, and it's interesting because you kind of go, this is Trainspotting, but rather than being written by Irving Welsh, it's being written by a posh middle class guy who
doesn't really know the world,
but does like tea and does, and you know, and it's like, it's, so I think on a kind of surface level it's very appealing, but I, you know, I can't imagine that there's much in it on an intense rewatch.
I'm curious now.
We really enjoyed that, you know, the coming together of all of those different plot points, and the, you know, you did it to Zorba the Greek, and you know, at that point it was, oh yeah, this is really kind of fun. And you've seen it so many times that Zorba that gets used, where you're kind of like, you can't, you know, it's not that I'm going, you know, there probably has been many uses of it before that point as well. But it's really hard for it to feel anything other than hackneyed. But then at the same time, structurally, it's such a really useful song. Like for a while with Nina, we tried to use Orba as a bit after. So Holly's moving in.
We didn't try and use it. We didn't want to use it.
No,
it was just a temptress.
But it just worked. It's such a great piece of music to edit anything to, and it just really worked. And it was like, oh god.
And so much of that is actually because you're going, well, it's the rhythm, and you're like, there aren't many songs which start slow and just get faster and faster and faster, and you're like, to watch that in a film is fun because you're kind of like, you know, just everything starts chasing. And
It's just interesting to think what time signature that Zorba the Greek's actually in.
God, I have no idea.
I don't know.
Because it's...
two.
Yeah, it's...
like, you know, to the power of six.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it certainly isn't... It could be, you know, about to say something really dumb, but I don't think it is an... it's definitely not a flat 4/4, you know, it's like that...
Yeah, you know.
And again, so it's very hard... You know, it's that interesting thing about coming to music is that so often that does kind of pull you into a 4/4 beat, which... can actually be something that you have to really struggle against in order to make an edit interesting.
Mm. People were talking about, oh, well, I cut on the offbeat or I cut on the... You're like, yeah, it's because you use a 4/4 music.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
If you used a waltz, you'd be having a whale of a time.
Well, you're inherently making it safe for yourself by using something that the audience can sort of pulse with. Which is, I mean, again, why Lust for Life is such an amazing opening, because you're just not given any consideration. I don't care if you've finished your popcorn, we're going. Like, the film just takes off.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually recreated that sequence.
With Barry, who gave us the chair that you sat on.
Yeah, with Barry, you gave us the chair that you sat on. We were doing a show called Where's Barry in Edinburgh. And the conceit of the show was that he'd woken up late for his show and he was handcuffed to his bed. And
he had a bunch of characters that he played throughout the show, and the idea was that the characters would all be people who were coming in to fill in for Barry because Barry hadn't turned up.
Okay. And then would occasionally cut to video of Barry trying to make his way to the venue. And part of it being Edinburgh was like, well, we're going to have to do a train spotting thing.
Yeah.
And he didn't realise that, he wakes up, he's handcuffed to the bed and somebody's drawn a dick on his forehead. And so then we made him run down the streets of, down Prince's Street and down those exact steps and fall over a car, but with a dick on his head. He had to do quite a few takes because it was all done we'd done it so that we'd mounted the camera to him just in front and he just ran off with it.
Yeah.
And so he had to get it right or else we'd just have to do the take again.
Yeah.
So there was quite a lot of him running around with a dick on his head in Edinburgh for a while. But...
which was also quite cruel, quite enjoyably cruel watching the footage back because, you'd be on like fourth take and he'd be like, okay, and set off. And then he'd do something wrong. And the beauty of it is, it's not like us going, no, cut, he'd know. Right. And he'd go, it's dark, okay, sorry guys, okay, let's do that again. It's just like, cruel, but enjoyable.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great start and such a great track, and so propulsive and really sets up the entire mood of the film, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of in terms of score wise, because there's there is no score. It's just all music.
Soundtrack.
Yeah, and there's so much of it.
Yeah. It goes from Lust for Life to Carmen, doesn't it? Carmen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, which is like your first sort of Clockwork Orange. We can use classical music as well.
Yeah. So there it is again. It's all these weird little images, all these twinnings.
Yeah, and using the wide angle lenses as well, that way of making at what are actually really quite small spaces really big. And the way that you can really dramatically change your aspect on a character within the same frame because obviously, they come close to the lens and they become huge and bulbous and, they just lean back and suddenly they're tiny.
Yeah.
And
that's where too, when with just which lens you shoot Ewan Bremner with turns him into a grotesquery so easily because his features are just so amazingly exaggerated.
He performs that so amazingly well as well, though. You look at the body shapes that
he's pulling.
He's contorting himself.
Completely contorting himself. And yet you're kind of, you're watching him, you're not going like, oh, why is he doing that? You're going, yeah, I've got friends who do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's instantly relatable. I mean, I was realizing, I'm just in my head, I'm like, did I miss something? And I realized we haven't spoken the names of any of the other actors other than McGregor. It's just because they are, Robert Carlyle doesn't exist. That's Begbie on screen. Yeah, I have seen that guy. And Bremner and Johnny Lee Miller, we might have mentioned him. And, I'm forgetting somebody else. Somebody obviously... Kevin McKidd, right. Yeah. And I found this out in researching. He was on vacation when they were... He was on holiday when they were shooting the advertising. So he doesn't appear in anything.
Is that why?
I've always thought that they just shafted him because they kind of like thinking, well, how are we going to sell this movie with four guys? Let's put Diane on the poster.
It's Kerry McDonald. That'll work.
And it's like it really did because I remember really clearly. I remember
the panels, right?
It's an amazing. I mean, it's masterpiece. I mean, in terms of like as a separate thing from the film, just in terms of a campaign, a marketing thing, a poster, a series of images. It's flawless. I remember when I remember girls at school absolutely relating, wanting to go and see the film because she was on the poster, genuinely.
It's a brilliant piece. Inclusion.
I remember the sixth form ball where Claudia Boxer being dressed in exactly that dress.
Let's leave that just hanging in the air. I think we should just leave that thought hanging in the air and what that means.
Everyone remembers what they remember.
They do. It's sad, tragic in a way if it was just because he was on holiday. Probably more tragic if he was shafted by Julia and the rest of the PR team putting that together, because it's fascinating again when you think about the film, probably because of that you go, oh yeah, Kelly MacDonald, Ewan McGregor, Robert Carlyle, Kelly MacDonald, and like those are the that stands out. When you actually look at who are the important characters, Kevin McKidd is
playing Tommy, you're going, he's the heart of the film, because you're going, so he's the, the angelic good one who's going to be the one who gets corrupted and killed.
And maybe that's it too, he doesn't make it to the end, so we just don't quite retain him. It's weird, because
again, in terms of
like narrative service,
because it's interesting, because in terms of what he gives you as an audience and what he gives you in a way as a director, when you're sort of having the discussions of kind of like, have you just made a film that glorifies heroin? Like, it's a very, very useful character arc and storyline, because you're like, no, I haven't, here's this guy who's really lovable and fantastic, totally honest is how he's introduced. It's like he cannot tell a lie, and by the end he's dying from HIV and brain tumor because of cat shit. It's like, it's totally grim. But you're quite right in terms of we have that story, we have the funeral, then they go and open a can of beer, and it's like, we've just got all these drugs, we're going to do this job, and it's Renton says, it's kind of like, we've just been to his funeral, and they're like, yeah, and then they move on from it, and it's like, in terms of the film, never actually points a finger at Renton and goes, you are fairly totally responsible for all the beats that lead Tommy there. Renton is
unquestionably him. Like, he introduces him to heroin.
He
begs, Tommy begs him for it, which is so bizarre.
It causes the breakup. So he steals the tape.
Oh, that's right.
And that's why Tommy breaks up with his girlfriend. His girlfriend breaks up with Tommy.
Yeah, but in terms of how the film ends with him going, I shafted my mates. He is referring to the three guys he's just left behind. He's not, at no point does he go, I did this, I am responsible for this. That never follows him. And it's like, it's interesting in terms of, in terms of where the film leaves you and how the film leaves you. It's Tommy's storyline doesn't haunt the character, and it doesn't haunt, you don't come away from the film going, God, it's about this guy who betrays his friend and his friend dies of toxic shock in a squat.
I mean, if anything, the baby is the wake-up call for Renton. That's when he quits. That's when he leaves. But Tommy's just a casualty of something that... I mean, maybe that's an effect of the narrator distancing himself from his responsibility. I was high, it doesn't count. Yeah. But it's really odd how it just doesn't hang in any way over the
end. Yeah, I wonder what would happen if you did actually give him the sense of guilt. Just in terms of, so the reaction to the film, where you're going, oh, this, it's a film where you can say, it glorifies heroin taking. You're like, well, if he actually felt guilty about the guy that has ended up dead, primarily because of the things that he's done, yeah, would that actually change, you know, your attitude towards the film as a whole, as what the film's trying to say? Because you're going, you know, I think it starts being about...
And interestingly, in terms of that last speech and him walking away and what that kind of leaves you with, that turns the film, for me, into a kind of, you know, as I said before, this sort of like political thing about society and about how this man fits into society and how his actions and behaviour fits into...
Yeah, yeah.
What the rest of us are doing. Whereas if the film ended with him, you know, having a responsibility for Tommy, then it does become a film about heroin.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it becomes a much, it encloses itself and it becomes just about that. And it becomes actually a much more comfortable film because I can sit back and I can watch and be like, yeah, that's why I don't do heroin.
Yeah, exactly. You're given an out. You're allowed to absolve, not absolve yourself, but you're allowed to never invest yourself.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. You can just leave it all behind.
Yeah. Whereas instead, you know, I'm sat there watching it on my big screen TV. So I'm no good at golf. But, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, I'm, you know, sat there in my life that I have chosen.
Yeah.
And the film does manage to rattle you still. It does kind of reach out and go, well, what are you doing? You know, How do you connect?
Yeah. Okay. Before we go, because that would be a perfect out, except that there's another question. You've already kind of addressed it.
Isn't that perfect for discussing your film? Like, yes. It would have the perfect structure, but no, actually, we want to go over here with it now.
Let me go. Well, the final question on the show is always the same, which is what of this film have you absorbed into your own work or cannibalized or stolen outright? Is there anything that influences you? You've referenced it, but have you taken its... I mean, some of the things in Nina Forever feel weirdly... Renton and Diane-y in the naturalism of the relationship in the midst of all the strangeness. That kind of rang a bell with me.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because again,
feed you the answer.
when we were discussing what we were going to talk about, obviously we were thinking kind of like, you know, what are the kind of immediate things that we knew we were referencing when we were making Nina? We were sort of, you know, trying to decide, you know, whether it was one of those films that we should talk about. And then this came up sort of out of the blue, really. But it's fascinating because it's something that we never mentioned, never kind of directly talked about when, you know, until obviously when we were talking about posters, because you can't talk about what do we want for the posters. Like, can we do Ewan McGregor? Can we have all the... No, we can't. That doesn't work. But, you know, like, obviously it has to come up then because it's one of the best ever. But when you kind of then sort of start kicking it around, particularly that... So going back to what we were saying at the start of that sort of sense of... It can be seen as this sort of naturalistic thing, but it's actually incredibly surreal and really ties into this stream of stuff. And I think a lot of people kind of want to put Nina in a sort of a horror box, which is great because those people love it. But for us, it was always more surreal and fantastical.
Yeah, and we were always thinking magic realism as our, you know, this is our genre. I know it's not a cinematic genre necessarily, but yeah, we're definitely in the magic real thing. And we're coming from that tradition of Dennis Potter, especially.
Yeah. One day iTunes will have magic realism and it will be us and Dennis Potter and Danny Boyle, you know.
Yeah. And then you're going, and Danny Boyle is definitely in that same spot. Trainspotting really is. There's so many fantastical elements in there. And also the cynicism.
Yeah.
Which doesn't come across as... You know, it's like a lovable cynicism. You know, it's not that you're going like, "Oh, you're such a cynic, and I don't really like you because you're being quite."
And again, it's that tension, isn't it? Because it's cynicism and naivety. Like, there's an incredible innocence to all of the characters, and I mean, Diane actually is a really interesting one because, like, she is exactly that, and she is simultaneously innocent, and when she is saying to him, like, you know, if you don't sleep with me again, I'll tell everyone that you've slept with me.
Yeah.
I mean, that is simultaneously a very, very cynical thing to do and a completely innocent thing to do.
Yeah, it's naive, but predatory.
Yeah.
She's going to be his partner in the estate agency. She'll be the one who murders the tenants to get the new ones in. It's like, she is, I mean, she's also the smartest character in the film because she is the clearest of everyone. She's direct. She threatens people, but she doesn't lie. She just doesn't tell the truth.
Yeah.
And that's interesting.
Yeah.
And Renton is repulsed by it, which is something fascinating. When he finds out just how honest she is, he doesn't want anything more to do with her.
Yeah.
But with Nina, you have a character who is dead and telling the truth all the time. and is like the magic realist thing is great because it gives her the excuse to know things that we don't know and understand things that we can't understand. And the characters she talks to are sort of trapped. Like, that's the beauty of it. They're literally trapped in the room with the ghost of your ex, but also she's not mad. I mean, every time I've tried to explain the film to people, they say, oh, so it's a horror movie. It's about vengeance. Like, well, no, she's just really cranky. She doesn't want to be there.
I think that's the real thing that a lot of people struggle with. And then eventually kind of go, oh, I see. And it's that moment when she's like, I don't want, and you know, I'm not here to claim my vengeance or to fight you for my
love. The thing, we don't, like, story wise we're not attracted at all to films that are about revenge.
Yeah,
you know, like the idea of making a thing which is, oh, I want to fuck you up because you fuck me up, you're like, it's quite boring actually, you know. And the thing that
well, it doesn't happen. I mean, it's not an emotion, admittedly, people coming back from But I believe Nina more than I believe revenge. I believe her motivation, because it's something that we feel or don't feel. It's the absence of involvement.
Yeah.
It's more interesting than the diluted bunny boiling caricature of somebody who just wants revenge. Nobody just wants revenge. People want, you know, pie. They get distracted.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you kind of think of like The Revenant, where you're kind of going, basically, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, mainly it's about him enjoying bison liver and snowflakes and then they eventually get to this point where they're like, oh shit, yeah, he definitely needs revenge actually, doesn't he, because otherwise what have we been doing?
Yeah, and that was always the stuff that confused me about the film, because it's like the stuff when he is in awe of this world that he is clinging desperately to stay in, and the stuff when he's eating bison liver and being like, this is the best meal, like the fish bit. I mean, when he eats that fish, that you're just like, yeah, it's so visceral, and so, you're so kind of like, yeah, you're not thinking about revenge. You're not thinking of, like, all of that stuff is there, but what you're thinking about is how great this fish tastes.
Yeah.
And that's what, you're right, that's what you believe.
That sort of Terrence Malick thing that Inarritu keeps chasing and not getting to because he is a robot who has no emotion, but I've got an episode coming up on The Revenant, folks, and it's going to be awkward.
We've never been particularly attracted to revenge stories, and there's so much more that's interesting. And so Nina's always been really interesting as a character to us, as someone who's got other thoughts and emotions.
Yeah. But I mean, going back to Trainspotting, revenge is interesting in that, because they're all characters who you can buy being driven by revenge, but there's no revenge in, like, Renton, like, is scared, you know, like there's that sense of kind of like, oh, if you screw over Begbie, there will be a revenge, you know, there's a sort of an intrinsic ... about being involved with Begbie, but that's a plot for another film that, you know, isn't the one they're making now, you know. It's like, that's not anything that anyone's actually interested in.
Yeah.
I mean, Begbie, he's more driven by obligation than anything else, I think. Like, he expects things from people.
Yeah.
And when they disappoint him, it becomes revenge.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he feels it that way. Like, he's just owed stuff.
Yeah.
Everything, constantly.
Absolutely,
owed to him.
Yeah, that's very true, yeah.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that you guys have lifted?
So, definitely saved? Something that, I mean, you know, Danny Boyle does amazingly in all his films, but especially in Trainspotting is the soundtrack. We knew that we wanted to be doing something similar in terms of soundtrack, not wall-to-wall music, but just that sense of picking the right tracks and having stuff that really fits and is really good music.
And the first
budget that we had for the film. So it's a really small film, and you know, it's all usually done on sort of percentages, and I think we had like 500 quid in the budget for music in its entirety, including the score. It might have been a grand.
I think it
might have been a grand.
It fluctuated.
and that was kind of like, well, we're never going to be able to afford to, you know, buy
any music,
and we know that music's really important, because, you know, they're young characters, they're listening to music, and just as importantly, there's something about the film, you add such an extra level, because you're kind of thinking, you know, if you think about the amount of time that it takes you, the amount of people to create the production quality, you know, you're always talking about money on the screen. And when you kind of think of the amount of time that people have taken, the moment of genius that it took them to record this music in just the right way that has, you know, stood the test of time, it's really worth the money.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Training Like a, you know, Atomic is just like, there I can think of no song that better encapsulates that moment of lust, that moment of seeing someone and knowing this is happening.
Yeah,
this is going to blow my mind, it's going to blow your mind. This is just like, and it, like, to take the bottle that emotion and to be able to just put it into a scene, it's like, you know, it's not that what's happening in that scene isn't also great, but you kind of go, that song gives you such a boost. Yeah. Like, it just, you just instantly, everyone is more attractive in that sequence because Debbie Harry is singing.
Yeah. To, you know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you, if you buy the soundtrack, it's not the Debbie Harry version, it's
Sleeper.
Sleeper. Yeah. It's a cover by Sleeper,
yeah.
Which I don't know whether that's them.
I assume they couldn't afford.
Either they had, yeah, either they couldn't afford Blondie, or they've tried to, you know, cut more into the Britpop fashion, possibly, yeah, of the time.
Yeah, that would make sense too.
But you're kind of like, well, you want the Blondie version because that's the one that really, you know, kicks you off in such a good way in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So music's really important to us in that same sort of way.
Yeah. But in the same way, I mean, you know, like there's the, like the other, there's other elements that as a filmmaker you can use that other people have poured their thoughts in. You know, it's like there's that brilliant bit in that sequence when he's in the club and behind him there's that mural painting of De Niro from Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was a painting that was done specifically by the art department for this film or whether that's a piece of art, yeah, that they'd kind of brought in, but either way it's drawn from Taxi Driver, you know, and it's like in that frame, kind of like if the wall behind him was blank, you get so much less from that moment, whereas kind of like you have Rent in there and then you instantly connect him to this iconic figure from cinema and this iconic, you know, it's like it's incredible, yeah, what you bring into something. So again, yeah, but the music is a really kind of clear one of like, well, yeah, we want as much great music as we possibly can, and music that kind of really just reaches out and connect. And
the key thing for us actually in terms of, you kind of you find that actually a lot of the time with music you really need the lyrics to fit,
yeah,
and when they don't, you know, like I hate films where, you know, it's like, okay, so this is like the happy bit, and so we've got a bit of music, and well, that montage only lasted for 20 seconds, and we're just going to do like a fade down.
Yeah, just turn it away.
Just turn it away. Mm. We don't really know what we're doing. We just kind of needed something there,
yeah,
and it was, and whatever.
The kids like Katy Perry. Let's put that in there. Yeah, yeah,
it's whatever's got batted your way, and yeah, you know, you kind of get a lot of suggestions for music. And I suppose actually that's a really key point for Nina, is that in terms of the film, it can, you know, it's like it's a film about grief. You know, it can be taken quite seriously. And the thing for us with the music, people would send us songs saying, hey, this would fit really well in the film. And you're like, yeah, it sort of encapsulates the feeling.
It's a beautiful, mournful song of, you know, someone alone with a piano singing, yeah, how sad they are. And you're like, yeah, but
there's no point in putting that in the film because everybody's already being mournful and sad.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
actually, the thing that we really want to have, and we knew really early on, was we really want drums, and we, yeah, want that propulsive, same, you know, the same sort of drive that, yeah, you're getting from Trainspotting, where, you know, it's not, we're not sticking in Lust for Life, but loads of the songs that we were starting out with, there's so much drumming,
yeah,
and it really was about, yeah, adding that extra element of
and again that element of fun. I mean, again, it's that thing, you know, like in terms of how the music works in Trainspotting, of kind of like, you go, here's something horrible happening on screen and I've put something bouncy and fun beneath it,
yeah, yeah,
and the two things aren't cancelling each other out. They're creating this interesting tension. And that was definitely something. And again, with the lyrics, I mean, like...
Yeah, so lyrically, in Trainspotting, you're going, you know, you've got Lust for Life.
But not only... I mean,
and
like...
And, you know, like, Temptation. I mean, yeah, like,
blimey. Some of it is, but I mean, Lust for Life, it's also interesting, like, when you watch it again with this in mind, like, there's a bit in the start when they're playing Lust for Life, when they're actually injecting, and the music actually just comes up, yeah, just ever so slightly, for Iggy Pop to shout, of course I've had it in the ear before, which isn't actually a reference to taking drugs,
yeah, but it just might as well be at this moment. Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
the connection, and you just kind of like, it's all those little details where you can see that they're not just putting on a music that, like,
yeah, perfect day.
Yeah, it's essential, yeah, commentary.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, so yeah, there's one particular bit in Nina where so it's the first time after Nina's arrived, and Rob's cleaning up the flat the next day, and we were trying to find the right music for it,
And we started out with a Fred Astaire track that we couldn't afford. And then we were like, okay, well, we know that ska can be cheap. And, you know, like we've had friends who've been able to afford ska music. And I love ska music. And so it was like, oh, well, there's this one, which works really well. It's by a band called The Melodians. And so we were pretty confident that we'd be able to get that one. And the quote for that was like double the amount of money that we had for all of the music in the film.
Yeah.
So can't have that one. And then searching through for ages and trying to find, because we knew it wanted to be a track from the past that had like this sort of slightly classic thing going on to it, that it didn't want to be like a modern day thing.
No, it wanted to feel really out of place, which I think was, again, like that whole sequence, the joy of it is like the like mixing that reality of I have to clean up my flat with the impossibility of I have to clean up my flat because my dead girlfriend has magically appeared and bled everywhere.
Yeah.
And so then having this kind of track that was out of time, I mean, as in from a different era rather than played badly, that was, what felt like a really nice way of encapsulating his emotion at that point.
Yeah, so we're looking through, listening to loads and loads of different British tracks, and going through the decades, you know, starting in the 50s and working forwards, and then eventually got to this track, this Adam Faith track. And literally, we were like, okay, well, let's try that with the film as it's cut at the moment, which is obviously a completely different track. So, you know, that sequence has changed massively depending upon what piece of music's been with it.
Sure.
And we stuck the Adam Faith on, and the lyrics are perfect.
Yeah.
And we haven't changed a single... Really? Yeah, we haven't changed a single frame of it. And it was just like, oh, there we are. That music works amazingly.
I think there were a couple of edits that were pulled like four or five frames, to be fair.
But that's it. It's just surgical.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it was so tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So trying to find those right tracks and how important it is to find a piece of music that doesn't just, you know, give you the right sort of mood, but also is actually saying something extra as well.
I mean, like, actually, and also, I mean, there's a piece of music that that Holly plays to Rob that we used twice, and again, that was a track that changed and changed and changed. But we really liked the idea of how, when you hear it first time round, it has one meaning, and then you hear it again and it has another meaning. And when we eventually found the track that we used, which is by Pearl and the Beard, we initially, they're a band that I sort of, you know, loved and just kind of like was on their mailing list, and it was their latest single, and they actually like put up this live version, and they're a three piece who like play cello, guitar and drums, and like the way they play live is really, really incredible. And they split up shortly after releasing that album, which is heartbreaking. And that was what I sent you. I was like, what about this? And you were like, yeah, this is great. And then we kind of like, sort of, you know, went to them and we'd like to use this. And they're like, yeah, here's the album version.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, oh. And it's great, but great in a different way. And what we actually convinced them to do, which was so nice of them, was that we used the album version the first time and the second time. But halfway through the second time, when it becomes really, there's a bit the second time when it becomes really, really soft and romantic, and we actually mix between the two.
Uh-huh.
And so in the sequence when she's giving him a bath, and it's just their performances are really touching, and we just go to the live, move into the live version, and it's really subtle because it's really nicely recorded, so you don't particularly ever go, oh, wait a minute, what's this sudden change?
Yeah, I certainly didn't catch it.
There's just something in the way in which Jeremy is singing, which is so from the heart and so, and like there's a because they're playing live, there's that extra bit of tension in the way in which they're doing it, and it's just magical. It just really kind of like brings out this kind of vibe between Abby and Kian when they're playing that scene. It's
And then sometimes lyrically you can be too on the nose.
Yeah,
so we have the song that Rob's listening to in the storeroom, that Holly's like, what are you listening to? And that comes back again later in the film. Yeah. So like the other one where we do it twice, and the song's actually called Motorbiking, and the chorus.
Well, and for those who haven't seen the film yet, and this isn't a spoiler, in that scene when we first hear it, he's discussing the motorbike accident he's just had.
Yeah. He might have been willing to fall off his bike and cause himself damage.
Yeah.
And the song itself has a bit which could be slightly too close to the story anyway, where it's, you know, my friend, you know, it's basically my friend
my friend just bought a brand new motorbike. He had a crash, fell off, and died. He went to the hospital, and he's alive again!
And, yeah, and those lyrics, you're like, okay, is that two on the nose? And for a while, we were a bit worried about that, but we were definitely like, well, motorbiking, the chorus, which is just motorbiking, motorbiking. You're like, that is way too on the nose. Yeah. But the song itself, like, and the drive that the bass line especially has going on in it, that just really felt perfect for that music. And yeah, it was really nice to do a mix of the track where they've never actually done like a proper recording of it, because it's a really
a band that we used to know really, really well, and they don't exist anymore, sadly, but this was like their kind of like set closer song, and right. So it was like everything would kick off and it would end with like everyone smashing everything, and like the singer would be out on the floor writhing in pain, and it was masterful. But obviously part of the joy of it is this real theatrical chaos, and it's very hard to then capture that on
in a recording studio where you're like, okay, let's do another take of that. You're like, you can't. So they've done demos of it, and so it was really nice to kind of bring out the best parts of that song the way that it's been recorded, that's in the film, and really gives you that energy that is there in the live set.
I think
actually in terms of recordings of the song, it's almost like the one that you're getting to hear on Rob's headphones is kind of like the best one, I think.
Yeah, it's like the closest to how it felt. But yeah, I mean, that's the other nice thing about it, is like it, in terms of like what score does, it really is about bringing in the the artistry of all the people who've made that piece of music. And it isn't necessary, you can often confuse it with, oh, it's about the audience knowing the track, right. It's about the recognition. And what's been great about Nina is that actually like two of the tracks that have had the most response from people have been that one, which was never released. It's a band that sadly folded before their first album was eventually released, you know. It's like no one knows them. And then there's another one that which is in the trailer and is also in the film, by like a two-piece from Minnesota, who again like I just found on the internet, and I'm not sure that they're playing anymore either. And both of them have had other tracks that people are kind of like, what's that song, that's brilliant. And it's what people are connecting to is not, oh, I know this band, it's what's this music. It's something
I feel this.
Yeah, exactly.
I suppose the last thing to think about in terms of stuff that we've taken from it is that structure of where you kind of go, like, forgetting for a moment talking about, like, we always talk about, we don't like to write in three acts, we write in five, and the difference between three or five, you know, you're kind of like, it's yeah, but anyway, beside that point, when you look at,
I know this,
but you you're looking at
I took theory.
Oh my gosh. You're looking at Trainspotting, and basically you're going, the most important moment is the midpoint. Mm. And actually that's when, you know, Renton changes and he's on a new path, and the film sets course and doesn't let go. It just goes in that exact direction.
Yeah. And to be clear, if you time it out, the midpoint of the film is exactly the moment when he falls through the carpet. It's like bang on it. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And
that to us is actually really important, is the midpoint, and finding the midpoint for Nina, because it changed in the edit.
Yeah.
And part of that's because of, you know, we started focusing the story on Holly and realising that her story was the most important one, and was the one that's going to pull you through.
And realising I think it was actually, because we always sort of had that in our heads, but I think we just got confused as to what the actual point at which she checked, like what her midpoint is.
Yeah.
And we convinced ourselves that it was with the parents.
Yeah, so she goes to see.
Mm,
And that actually happens quite late on.
Yeah.
And the real turning point is, you know, when you talk about the film, you go, okay, so the story is about Holly. She's trying to help Rob through his grief, and she's fallen in love with the dude. And the first time that they make love, Rob's dead girlfriend, Nina, comes back and is all bloody and messed up in the bed with them, and essentially takes the piss out of them every time they try and get intimate. And the key turning point in the film is that Holly, initially she does run away, but the second time she doesn't. And the film's about, well, why has she stayed?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so then you're like, oh, that's the midpoint, because up she to stays, that point, yeah, she's not been staying, and now she is. And what happens when you stay? What happens when you stay in one of those relationships? Well, guess what's coming to you? Yeah. You know, you're kind of like, now for the ride down the hill. You're kind of, and so structurally, we kind of are following a similar path
yeah.
in a way. I mean, you know, we definitely go around the houses as well in terms of bouncing off in different ways story-wise.
Yeah, and again, we were really keen to do that. We were really adamant that we didn't want to kind of tell the story in a familiar way, and that we wanted to constantly have the audience feeling, where are we now? Why is this happening? And it's like, particularly because it's like we knew that we had this big kind of like, well, Nina's going to appear, and that's quite a kind of like, whoa, what the fuck?
Yeah.
But if you're doing that, the rest of it can't be, you can't drop into a rhythm. And it's like, but you equally, you can't have like, you know, other dead people appear. You know, it's like, so yeah. how do you have to
calibrate the strangeness. You have to know exactly. I mean, you could, I guess you could bring in other people, but then you're into like an American Werewolf situation or a Truly Madly Deeply thing where the world becomes more important than the relationship.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, you can't really do that satisfyingly and keep it in an intimate footing.
Yeah.
So when did you realize that was that, you know, the second thing had to be their relationship? Or was that always the point?
It was always the point, but it was kind of like that realization of, I suppose,
that's a lot of time when you talk, that's the hinge.
When you talk about...
That it stays about the two.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's about a character changing, I suppose, because, you know, when it was about the parents, it's about Holly starting to realize something about their relationship, whereas actually the change in her is, I've committed to it.
Yeah, it's like her relationship. I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's like her relationship with Rob is actually secondary to her relationship with herself.
Yeah.
And the film is actually her journey from being, my ex-boyfriend is saying I'm too vanilla and not dark enough, and me and other people I work with are saying I'm weird, and I want to be weirder than they think I am. I want this darkness in my life. There's this guy, he's dark and interesting. I want that in my life to... I now definitely have that in my life.
Yeah.
Did I want that? I'm not so sure, but I have this, you know, and it's like, that's what the journey of the film is. And the midpoint is, well, I'm sticking with this guy and I'm going to try and make this, you know, like it was it's her revelation to herself of, I've got the strength to come back into this and I want to stay here for me as much as I want to stay here for you.
Mm.
And it was rather than kind of like her realizing, maybe there's a problem in my relationship with him. That's
right.
A secondary thing, actually.
Yeah. So you've actually done it. It's a coming of age film and a film about someone who can't escape his past.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, we took quite a lot from Trainspotting with that.
My thanks to Chris and Ben Blaine, whose deliriously odd debut, Nina Forever, is available for rental and purchase on iTunes right now in North America. If you're in the UK, it's also available on Blu-ray and DVD with a few special features. Get it. It's really something. You can find Chris and Ben on Twitter at Blaine Brothers, all one word, and you can find Trainspotting on Blu-ray and DVD from Lionsgate in the US, Entertainment One in Canada, and 4DVD in the UK. It's also streaming on Netflix in the US and Canada and available for rental and purchase on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. And if you want to leave a review on iTunes, this week's phrase is Mother Superior. Thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.